Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, July 21st, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
You know, you're looking at that shirt. You're just smiling. Oh, it's very nice.
Beautiful shirt, by the way, Larry.
Yeah, this was a gift. Someone from Australia sent it to another podcast.
So much Australian.
Yeah, so I got the kangaroo. Drive me kangaroo down, mate.
Larry, let's start with your latest article on sonar21.com. Here is what you wrote, defining Islamic extremism and what it means for Syria and what's going on in Syria. What are you trying to picture for us?
Well, there's a lot of terms are tossed about. You know, you'll hear the term Wahhabi. You'll hear the term Salafist. And then Takfir. and so my goal was to try to just help define some of those terms. But, you know, as I was writing it and reflecting upon, you know, sort of past terminology, I think we've made a real mistake of identifying Al-Qaeda, the bin Laden organization, as a Salafist movement. Now, what are we talking about? So the Wahhabism is, it's a Saudi Arabian origin, 18th century. And it's a, you know, to put it in terms for Christians to understand, it's a return to the fundamental, to the basics. You know, sort of no frills, no extra. This is a notion of the true religion. Man, it was largely confined to Saudi Arabia. That was the influence from there. The Salafist movement is similar to the Wahhabi, and it comes out of. but it emerged more in the late 19th, 20th century. Again, the same notion of we're the ones who have the truth, and within that comes, if you will, an intolerance of other Muslims. Now, the reality is the vast majority of Muslims in the world are not, you know, not adherents to either Wahhabism or Salafism. You know, they're normal people, and they're not out because one of the tendencies out of these movements is to declare other people, you're not a real Muslim. You're not, you know, like, you're not a good Christian. So when you get people that take their religion and then invest it where they've become the judges of others, that then out of that, you get violence, such as what we're seeing in Syria. Now, here's the real interesting twist, and that's why I say Al-Qaeda was not one of those. Al-Qaeda was, yeah, they were motivated by religion as far as their Muslim faith, but it was really more of an anti-imperialist, anti-US, to attack the United States, try to weaken the United States for what they saw as its interference throughout West Asia. they were not of the same ilk as, say, ISIS. You know, when ISIS emerged in Iraq under Baghdadi?
Sheikh Yassin, yeah.
No, it was actually before that. But it was around 2005, 2006. Yeah.
Well, it was Baghdadi, Abu Bakr Baghdadi.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, he was young, Larry.
Yeah. And, you know, he was coming out of it with a Salafist mentality and attacking other Shia Muslims, for example. And that led to a letter that both bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman Zawahiri, you know, said basically, what the hell are you doing? Stop this. You know, we're Muslims. We're brothers of the faiths, you know. So right there was showing that distinction. Now, I raise all of this because when you go back 30 years, go back actually into Afghanistan in the 1980s, when the CIA was starting to reach out and fund Islamic jihadists, some of whom were Salafists, that was a point where the CIA started working with groups that, depending on the day, the United States labels them as terrorists. And then the next day there are allies, you know, so we got this. It shows that this war on terror is actually a complete fraud from the standpoint of it's not based upon some principle that we're against people who are religiously motivated to kill others. I wish we were, because if we had that standard, then we would be against Israel killing the Palestinians, because they're murdering Christians, they're murdering Muslims. So it's you've got this tendency. So that was what I was trying to focus on. And now what the relevance to Syria is the PBS show Frontline did a show recently about the rise of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. Well, in my article, there's this wonderful cartoonist named Nemo. Now, he titled the cartoon wrong, but it's sort of like the evolution from ISIS to al-Shara right now. And it is, if you pull that up so people can see it, start off with ISIS, then you get al-Nusra, then you get HTS. Hey, now he's the guy in the Brooks Brothers suit with the trim beard and the shorter hair. And, we've been backing a terrorist, someone that we claimed that we were fighting. And Ambassador Jim Jeffrey in this Frontline series, admits, hey, yeah, we're in contact with them. We're negotiating with them. It's really sort of an ugly secret that has been hidden from the American public over the years, because it goes back to, say, 1999 with the start of the Second Chechen War in Russia. Well, the Chechens, these were Muslim extremists that had the backing of the United States through the CIA and British MI6. And these people, like even al-Shara, they're tools. They're pawns that the West is using to move around, to create mayhem, to bring about regime change. So that's what I was addressing in this.
Laurie, how do you find the case of Syria under the pressures coming from the United States, from Turkey? How about the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Force, that I thought that they have joined the government in Syria? It seems that that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be an expert on the SDF. All I know is that today the West issued some sort of, the United States and Turkey issued some sort of ultimatum. You better join up with us, al-Shara's government in the next 30 days or else. Or else what? I suspect that underlying this are some important tribal, familial factors that are driving the dynamics. And you're seeing that down south with both the Druze and the Bedouins. I think as we talked on Friday, when you lay out all of the different ethnic groups in Syria, it's not homogenous, that's for sure. And the cultures of the Druze and the cultures of the Alawites are something that we here in the West, we simply don't understand. We don't have any benchmark to measure it against. And so without understanding how deep those differences are. And then when you're dealing with the regular, let's call it the normal Shi population, because both the Druze have an element of Shi Muslim, Islam, but, you know, they've Greek philosophy, Christianity, you know, it's very unique. The Alawites are seen as really a sort of a spinoff, a breakaway from the Shi community. Then you got the Sunnis, Muslims, you got the Kurds, and Erdogan appears to want to try to control the situation, but clearly has been unable to. And, you know, the Russians are still there providing some safe haven for many of the locals. You know, they come and camp out around the Russian base, hoping that the HTS crew, these Salafists. Now, and let me make one other comment about that. What's fascinating is that many of these Salafists, you know, these true believers, they're not actually really practicing Muslims. You know, they're not disciplined and praying five times a day. They don't, making the Hajj, to go to Mecca. That's not on their list. And, you know, alcohol, pornography, things that, you know, strict, you know, more what I call Orthodox Muslims practice, you know, reject the Western ways. These guys don't. This is really sort of, if you will, they become tools of the West. And it's really about power. And so now when you get into Syria, the thing I don't have a good database on, but just I suspect this is one of the major factors that has to be taken into consideration, is there are some criminal organizations that are, or let's call it groups, family groups, tribal groups, that handle smuggling of major products, smuggling of oil, smuggling of gas, smuggling of other key products. And whoever controls those networks actually is a powerful force that has to be dealt with. And they're not, I suspect they're not under the control of al-Sharr's government by any stretch. And by virtue of their, you know, the money that they make through the smuggling, they're able to, you know, they buy weapons, they can buy an army. So this is, what we've got here is just a recipe for chaos. I don't see it coming under any kind of control or normality anytime in the future.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the situation is somehow complicated. It seems that within the Druze community, we have different factions.
Yeah.
And Israel is trying to influence those factions to be closer to Israel.
Yeah. I mean, let me just use a simple example. Again, I try to put it in the context for Westerners. Maybe the average Muslim sitting in Indonesia or Malaysia or, let's say, even Saudi Arabia looks at the Catholic Church as a monolith, thinking, oh, yeah, that's, you know, it's one. But those who are within Catholicism know that you've got different factions, different sects, really, within the Catholic Church. Some that are, you know, we're going to have traditional Latin Mass. That is true Catholicism. Others who are much more liberal. So the same thing exists within Islam. And that's part of what we're seeing here. So it's we have a tendency to try to oversimplify and put people into these monolithic blocks that, frankly, are just artificial constructs.
Turkey says that they're going to support al-Jolani till the end. And I don't know what that would be. And al-Jolani. Yeah. But no, because the future under Jolani or al-Sharr and whatever his name, his family name is, it's not that bright that Turkey wants to put all its eggs in his basket. And do you feel that Turkey is making a smart move, or they have they made it, they have to continue supporting the government in Syria?
Yeah, well, this he's an artificial construct. Jelani, aka Ashara, he's not organic. What I mean by organic, just like when the Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran, he had a base, a wide base of support among the clerics and among the people. So he was not being imposed from the outside. And whereas al-Shara is, and I forgot, you know, in the previous question about the Druze, it is important again to understand they're split. You've got Druze that are living in Israel. You've got Druze that are living in Syria. The Druze, they spread out, and just because they come out of that same background and heritage, doesn't necessarily mean that they share a unified vision. And coming back to al-Shara, he doesn't have a natural base of popular support by any stretch, and his ability to, if you will, win the loyalty of the Druze population. He's attacking and killing. His people are attacking and killing Alawites and Christians. And one of the traits of the people in this region, they don't have Alzheimer's disease. They don't forget. They remember. If you've killed members of my family, we will remember and hold you accountable. It is, in the United States, you know, hell, we can't remember what happened 2 weeks ago. You know, we forget. You know, it may be something bad, but these folks remember specifically. And I recall one of my colleagues. I may have told the story before. At the agency, he was running an asset out of one of these West Asian countries, and you know the guy showed up at one of their meetings, and was really upset, and so my friend said, well, what's wrong? And he said, oh, you know, this group had come and they'd killed this many women and children, and man, it was a massacre, and it was. You know, and it was just so he was very upset about it. And my friend said, "Oh, I haven't heard about this." So he starts writing it down. When did this? Where did this take place? What happened? How many? And then we got to the crew. So when did this occur? The guy stopped and said, 740 A.D." You know, it was like 1,000+ years ago. But he was talking about it, and he was not pretending. He was talking about it as if it had happened last week or last month. And again, that's a cultural difference. But you know, there's a strength, there's a positive aspect to that cultural. People don't forget; they remember, and they have a heritage. So their heritage and their ancestors, it's important. So that's part of what we're dealing with here, that this al-Shara is an artificial construct by the West. It's just being planted there in hopes that, you know, he's going to somehow acquire authenticity and popular support. Right? It's not going to happen. This is, I don't want to say it's like Vietnam, you know, where the United States kept putting in a new leader here and there, and you know, whereas the North Vietnamese had authentic leaders that had a base of popular support. We have a tendency, it is a tendency on the part of the CIA, you want to put in place people that are, if you will, like you, that you can talk to, that give you the feedback that makes you feel, oh yeah, I like this guy. You know, he's reliable, he's trustworthy. And maybe not, maybe really isn't, but at least he's figured out how to shine you on, you know. So,
Larry, Mike Huckabee went to the West Bank to meet with the Christian community there. And does the United States feel comfortable about what's going on in the West Bank and the way that Israel is treating, and somehow we haven't seen anything, because at least we thought that the Trump administration would do something in that term, because these people who are supporting the administration, mostly Christians, they want to respect the values. But how about the administration, the way that Huckabee is talking about? He's somehow trying to play both sides, and he doesn't want to upset the government in Israel. What's going on there?
No, actually, I took that as, I suspect that Huckabee didn't even realize that there were Palestinian Christians. Huh. I thought they're all Muslim, you know? Yeah, because you saw actually yesterday as well on one of the Sunday talk shows, even Lindsey Graham, you know, the little old lady from South Carolina, he was upset about the attacks on Christians by the settlers. So they're actually now starting to make that, you're hearing from both Huckabee and Graham, and I think it's a welcome development, the acknowledgement that these settlers are really, they're pure evil. They're the problem, not just part of the problem. They are the problem, because they reflect this entire notion that this is our land. God gave this land to us. Nobody can have it, and we can do whatever we want to you. And so here's Huckabee suddenly discovering, oh my God, they're attacking Christians. Good, wake up to that. And, you know, it's actually over the last couple of weeks, you know, I think Israel's maybe have, you know, recognized they've crossed, I don't know if they acknowledge that they've crossed the line, but you've had the attack on the Catholic Church there in Gaza, which has elicited from finally the new Pope some direct condemnation of Israel over that. And then you've got Huckabee going into the West Bank and meeting with the Palestinian priest and listening to the stories from those people. And, you know, I don't think Huckabee is a stupid person. He's not an imbecile. He does have some intelligence, but he had up to this point allowed his own mistaken beliefs about the Zionist enterprise to blind him to the fact of the persecution of the Christians that has taken place. And then with Lindsey Graham commenting on it. So I think it's a real thing. And then you couple that with what's been going on in Syria. Because Syria's had one of the oldest Christian communities in the world. And they're being attacked and killed. So at least now that's starting to become, I'm hoping it becomes a factor.
Here is Larry, what a British surgeon, he tries to describe what he has been witnessing in Gaza. Mm-hmm. It seems that Israelis are just killing children, just
yeah, they are
for sport and
murdering.
Here is what he said. Yeah.
In the emergency room, describe a very clear pattern where on particular days they'll see different body parts targeted. So on one day they'll all be abdominal gunshot wounds. On another day they'll all be head gunshot wounds or neck gunshot wounds. On another day they'll be arm or leg gunshot wounds. And on last Saturday, there were four young teenage boys all brought in very, very rapidly in succession with gunshot wounds to their testicles. So they'd clearly been targeted to their testicles. And this is a pattern that we're seeing every day, that these young teenage boys are systematically being targeted. And it's almost as if a game is being played, that they're deciding to shoot the head today and the neck tomorrow and the testicles the day after.
This is the scale of this crime that the government of Israel is committing is on par with that of the Nazis during World War II. And in fact, if you could measure it out in sort of a per capita basis, yeah, it's horrific. The images of these starving Palestinians in Gaza now, they begin to resemble the folk, the inmates who were incarcerated in places like Bergen-Belsen, Sachsenhausen, Dachau, that they're walking skeletons. You know, the Jews of that period called those, who were, emaciated, skin and bones, Muslims. And now here you're having it. I don't know if I saw George Galloway did a great emotional rant at the start of his latest episode of The Mother of All Talk Shows. And showed video footage of an elderly man who just literally died while standing there in line trying to get food. It just, the life left his body. He died. The children that are being targeted, shot, blown to bits, crushed with falling debris. It is, the Palestinian people have now been putting up with this for 21 months. It's a nightmare for them. And the world, with really the exception of the Houthis, standing by and doing nothing. And this includes, I level it even as a criticism of Russia and China. For God's sake, do something. The governments that have power, do something. Stop this. Israel has to be stopped. Because, ultimately you're hoping that the Jews that are opposed to this Zionist madness will finally rise up and say, this is not us. This is, we are desecrating. The number of Israeli soldiers starting to commit suicide, it's going up. And I just saw one where one soldier apparently committed suicide in front of his other colleagues. And the commanding officer yelled at him, stop whining, got to suck it up. There are still people of conscience with a consciousness in Israel that understand that this is evil and wrong. But the Zionists are possessed of this madness that's sustaining it. The images are sickening. And all we can do is, at least highlight it, talk about it, to try to get people energized to put pressure on their governments to extend. In the United States, where, Donald Trump's administration is firmly in the grasp of this Zionist clique. And, I don't think there's any hope there for the United States to back away and change its policy.
It seems to me, Larry, that they're not going to back down on the way that they're killing civilians in Gaza. But after all, the society, the army from within would collapse if they continue this way. Because they cannot. It's somehow unbelievable. You cannot go this way. You are destroying everything. You are destroying the society from within.
Well, Israel's losing its soul. It is when you engage in this kind of monstrous behavior, you become that. You know, you become what you're doing. But what I find incredible is that Hamas has been able to survive and be, they continue to carry out effective ambushes where they're killing and wounding Israeli soldiers on a regular basis. And some of the images, the bravery on the part of these Hamas fighters is really, I don't want to say it's remarkable, because that suggests that there was no reason to believe that they were brave or courageous. But you see them run with an explosive charge and like a backpack at a tank, where the tank crew's in there, but they approach from a blind side, are able to get throw the bag in and blow the tank up and kill and wound the crew. And it's not just one. I've seen multiple videos of this. So, this is, I don't know if you were ever familiar with the Leon Uris book, Mele 18, which, told the story of the Jewish uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II. And, Uris is portrayed as a heroic account. And, here were these, it was a small number of fighters, and they hardly had any weapons at all with which to engage the German troops. They lasted about 3 weeks before they were wiped out by the German Wehrmacht. My God, here's Hamas. They're going up against an army that has every material advantage, every advantage in weapons and supplies and intelligence, and Israel can't beat them. They're still fighting. And, you got to step back and say, okay, what are they fighting for? And you realize that at root, what Hamas is fighting for is human freedom and dignity. They're not fighting to exterminate the Jews, even though that's how it's portrayed, that if you lie to Hamas, it's going to lead to a new Holocaust. Well, by God, the only one committing Holocaust right now is Israel against the Palestinians. And it's just an objective fact. And the United States is the great enabler of it, unfortunately.
Larry, Lindsey Graham on Fox News has suggested to deal with India, China, and Brazil. And here is what he said, Larry.
Oh, China, India, and Brazil. If you keep buying cheap Russian oil to allow this war to continue, we're going to tariff the hell out of you, and we're going to crush your economy, because what you're doing is blood money. You're buying cheap Russian oil at the expense of the world, and President Trump is tired of this game. If I were President Putin, I would get to the table soon, because he's about to get crushed.
Blunt and plain spoken as ever.
Blood money.
Yeah, he's a buffoon. Likes to tout family values and engages in conduct, reportedly, according to people like Roger Stone, that allows him both to be manipulated and coerced behind the scenes. What he's talking about here trying to impose onerous tariffs on, India, China, Brazil, that are going to have the blowback effect on the U.S. economy. I mean, he's not an economist. He was had some training, is a lawyer, has a law degree. And, I guess he understands how to have money funneled into his secret bank accounts, or how to get rich while being a politician.
And nobody's talking about it, by the way.
And just go look at what how Lindsey Graham's net worth, based upon financial reports he's required to file, has changed since he went into Congress. He's become a multi-millionaire. How does that happen when you're making, you know, $180,000 a year? I forget the exact salary, but the salary for a member of Congress is not such that you are going to become a multi-millionaire if you're very frugal and you save the money or you invest it in wild stock market speculation. So the man's corrupt. And you know, the notion that they're going to bully Russia, China, and Brazil. I just before, you know, dialing into you today, I saw a report that Russia is setting up a new gold market exchange in Moscow. They're breaking out of what has been the London bullion market. And according to this article, this London market has controlled the gold market. How do you set the price of gold, et cetera, for 300 plus years? Now, Russia, and I'm sure with the cooperation of China, is doing it. And there's other news that China is now selling off its U.S. Treasury bills. That kind of talk by Graham forces these other countries to recognize, you know what, we cannot be in any position where the United States can attack us economically, can attack us financially. We've got to take steps to ensure ourselves against that. And as a result of these kinds of actions, the West is actually, it's cutting its own throat. It's just cutting off parts of its body. The example is, you try to sanction Russian ships. Well, the sanction on the ships is that you go after that if they're wearing a Russian flag, they don't get insurance. Well, who's the big insurance provider? It's been provided out of London. So what has happened as a result of this is the so-called creation of ghost fleets. But they're not ghost fleets. They're simply tankers that are no longer insured by the Brits. They're being insured by Russia. So you've got an alternative insurance market developing out there so that those who own those ships no longer, you know, if there's damaged, if it's sunk, if it's attacked, whatever, now you've got the money, the insurance money is backing it, is coming out of Russia. And I think countries like Russia and China, they recognize that they can no longer be in a position where they're going to be held hostage to the financial markets in London and New York.
Here is what you said about China, Larry. Here is Financial Times report reporting that China's treasury holdings have fallen below those of the United Kingdom. You see the line in red.
Yeah, the red line going down, that's China.
Yeah. China is going down. 2025, you see it comes below the UK one.
How did you know I was going to talk about that?
Because I was going to bring it up.
Oh, hey, man, great minds think alike, right?
And it seems, Larry, for China has changed a lot. And look at their political sort of attitude. You look at their economy, how they're trying to be independent, more independent from the United States. Do you feel that China is somehow, what has happened to Iran, to Russia, is somehow knows that it's going to happen to him in the near future, but they don't know when that's going to happen. They're preparing for that.
I call it the baby elephant and the rope. So story goes that a baby elephant initially is chained with a heavy chain, And it gets so used to having that chain around its leg, it realizes I can't get away. I can't break free. So in its mind, anything that's tied around its leg, it's trapped. As it grows and gets bigger and stronger, finally, the owners, the people who are, you know, let's call it own the elephant, or trying to control the elephant, they can then put just a rope, a light rope around the ankle. But because that elephant's been conditioned to think, oh my God, anything I can't get free, it remains trapped until the day comes when it pulls on it and it breaks and it realizes, hey, I'm no longer chained to that. That is the transformation we're seeing in Russia. We're seeing in China. We're starting to see in India, and we're starting to see in Brazil. For too long, there was this belief that, oh my God, we can't live without the United States. The United States, the United States dollar, the United States, hey, boy, we better do what they say or else they're going to make us suffer. And now, particularly in China, I know there are many in the United States that like to think that, you know, China is this rigid, authoritarian communist state. There's no creativity. There's no ingenuity. There's no, everything they have, they've just stolen from the West. They haven't created anything on their own. I saw a quick TikTok video yesterday about one of these Chinese cars. It is, you open the side door and the seat actually moves, swings out, so you could stick an old person like me in it. You know, you get in and then you press another button and it goes in and puts itself. Then there's another mode. You can have meeting mode. So it's got three rows of seats in this car. You hit another button. The two seats in the middle, they rotate around and face backwards. And then you got a 30-inch television screen comes down in the friggin' car. I mean, the level of technology on this Chinese car, we don't have anything like that in the United States. But we like to pretend, oh, those Chinese are just stealing all of our good ideas. Male bovine excrement. I'm not going to be as crude. But it's just like the Chinese, from an industrial standpoint, have surpassed the United States. We like to pretend that we're the best, we're the most modern, we got better stuff than you. And the reality is, no, that's, that ship's come and gone. And so our only option, our only response to this is what? To try to make war on China. Yet, you know, the United States is militarily capable of inflicting great damage on China, but it is not militarily capable of sustaining an attack, and the retaliation and ultimate blowback from not just China, but from Russia would, you know, the mark the end of the United States, the end of it. So If the United States doesn't figure a way to break free from this military fever, it's going to destroy us. We're going to end up destroying ourselves. And we've already got, you know, we've seen the indicators of that with what's happened with respect to the war in Ukraine, because, you know, we can't produce missiles, ammunition, artillery, and any other weapon system at any rate, any kind of replacement rate for the losses that are going on. We cannot. Is commenting that these, like in Ukraine right now, and the drone technology that came out of China, but now it's going exclusively to Russia. But Russia's developed sort of its own capabilities as well. But, you know, they produce a Garand drone for, say, $50,000. And the Ukrainians are firing upwards of 4 Patriot missiles to try to bring down one of those drones. Okay, here's a $50,000 drone coming in. and they fire four Patriot missiles. Each of those cost $7 million, $28 million to take down a $50,000 drone. You're going to go bankrupt at that rate. And so here's China with, you know, this massive industrial base. Now, they've got problems, you know, and they're, I'm not trying to suggest that they're not engaged with some nefarious activity, you know, the fentanyl that has been pouring out of China and killing, you know, hundreds of thousands here in the United States, you know, is a real problem. And there's ways that that needs to be addressed. But the United States' desire to portray China as an enemy, the ultimate enemy, because you get people talking about it, even John Mearsheimer, dearly loved John, but, you know, I think he's blind when it comes to, you know, how you're going to deal with China. And now you got this Elbridge Colby, the grandson of Bill Colby, sitting in the Department of Defense. And the idea is, you know, we're going to have to confront China. We're going to have to confront China. No, we don't have to confront China, for God's sake. Let's figure out a way that we can work together so it's to the mutual benefit of each other. Now, that's what China and Russia are doing. Russia's, you know, to its credit, has figured out they don't require an ideological litmus test. That you got to believe what we believe, or we're not going to deal with you. If you sit down and lay out the political philosophies that dominate in Moscow compared to Beijing, they're different. But they figured out a way to say, hey, we're different, but we can get along. Same with like North Korea. You know, Russia doesn't get hung up on this, you know, ideological litmus test. The United States does, but as we pointed out at the start of our discussion, the United States is very hypocritical because, you know, we're against terrorism. Hey, those terrorists over there, let's give them some money and aid so they can go create some mayhem. Now, which is it? You're against it or you're in favor of it? So this is a long way of coming back to where we started, that China and Russia have broken free of this belief that they are tethered to the West. And they're going to continue to break free in every area possible. They're not going to look for a confrontation necessarily, but they're becoming more assertive. And, you know, before we could almost describe it as a paternalistic system. And, you know, you'll discover this in a few years when your kids become teenagers and want to start asserting their independence. But there comes a point in that parent-child relationship where the child has to break free to be on their own. And they don't always make the choices that the parent wants, but they become their own person. And China and Russia have fully stood up on their feet and said, hey, we're our own person. We're no longer dependent upon you, the West. You're going to treat us respectfully and as equals, or, you know, we'll find another way to, we'll go our own way. And that's one of the reasons that I think China is now saying, you know, they, in the past, they were willing to play along and buy the U.S. treasuries, basically enabling our addiction to spend. And, you know, we could always count on the Chinese to come through with the cash to fund our addiction. Now they're saying, yeah, we're no longer interested in that. And the belief here in the United States is, they could never do that because our money's so important to them. They can't live without us. And what happens when comes that moment that the rest of the world wakes up and says, yeah, you know what? We can live without the United States. It's no longer the gold standard of currency. In fact, we're going to use the gold standard, our own gold, which is why we're taking control, going to get some control over the gold market, the global gold market, where Russia and China control it and not London.
Larry, the United States, if we assume that they have a grand strategy, they have some sort of a big picture of what's going on. There has to...
Oh, come on. Boy, have you been taking hallucinogenics this morning? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm rude. I'll let you finish.
The reason I'm mentioning this, Larry, because when we look at the way that the United States treated Russia with a proxy war in Ukraine, mm-hmm. a proxy war between Israel and Iran, if we assume that's a proxy war, in Taiwan, I think the era of proxy wars, because they have started with sanctions, then go with tariffs and weakening the governments, hollowing the society from within. That didn't work for in Venezuela, in Cuba, for Iran. It didn't work. For Russia, it doesn't work. It is not working for the United States in Russia. It seems that those days are gone, and the United States is so used to sanction, accustomed to the way that they were using sanctions against other nations. They cannot separate from them. It's something so addictive, and they're so addicted to what they've been doing, and they cannot ignore, they cannot just leave it alone. How is that going to be, Larry, when it comes to what do they have? They have sanctions, doesn't work. Tariffs didn't work against China. And they're talking about right now China, India, and Brazil. They don't ask themselves why. Because in Brazil, if you try to do that to Brazil, you're going against the economy of Brazil. It's not something to, it's not all about the president. It's about the security of a country, a big country. In India as well, you can argue that India is so close to the West, they're trying to do everything to be closer to the United States. But after all, the national security of a country is much more important than anything else. Who's going to provide India with energy? Who's going to provide China with energy? Brazil as well. We assume that they can eliminate Russia. It's impossible to go in that direction.
Yeah. No, it is. Like I said, this process of breaking free from U.S. control, it's underway. And Donald Trump, he tried to pretend, you know, I don't know if you saw his comment the other day that BRICS is fading away. They're fading. And he was, I mean, the guy's delusional. He talked about, you know, they had that meeting in Brazil and nobody showed up. It's like, who's briefing you? Stop watching Fox or, you know, have decent information about what's going on. Acknowledge it. But I wrote a piece two nights ago at sonar21.com about the CIA the war on Russia. And it was based on this article in Foreign Policy, which is a journal of the deep state. Let's call it a journal of the deep state. And it was written by Tim Weiner, who is the author of this book called Legacy of Ashes, which is the history of sort of the first 40 years of the CIA, 40, 50 years. And what was in this article, basically, he was portraying this recently retired CIA officer who headed up the operations, you know, the ones that controls all the spies overseas. And the thrust of the article was to portray Donald Trump as a stooge of the Russians, and that the Russians were still manipulating things. This article came out just before Tulsi Gabbard then released all the information showing that the entire 2016 claim about the Russiagate was a fabrication, a complete fabrication, and it involved a conspiracy in which the director of the CIA, John Brennan, and James Comey, and the director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, all conspired to hide, suppress the intelligence that showed that Russia had not interfered in order to create the narrative that Russia was interfering and Donald Trump was under their control. But throughout that article, as Weiner's you know, trying to present this case. And you then get he has some astonishing quotes. There was the director, the article's focused on a guy named Sylvester. Prior to Sylvester becoming the head of the Directorate of Operations, there was another fellow named Rakusan, Tomas Rakusan. And Rakusan reportedly in 2016 or 2017 ordered the CIA, ordered his officers to go out and, quote, recruit terrorists to attack Russia because of Russian interference, except Russia hadn't interfered. And as head of operations, he would have known that. So it was just a deliberate lie to try to attack Russia. And then what you realize is this, for since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, despite attempts, I know that Milton Bearden, who at one point had been, I think he was director of operations, or at least he was in a senior position for the Near East Asia. He tried to scale back and say, okay, we got to have a normal relationship with Russia. At some point in there, the decision was, we're not going to have a normal relationship with Russia. We're going to portray Russia as an authoritarian communist state, regardless of what's actually taking place in it. And therefore, we're going to continue to attack and subvert. And this was ongoing. Now, what you realize is that even though Donald Trump was president between 2017 and 2021, January 2021, the actual policy with respect to attacking Russia and subverting Russia was being carried out in the CIA. And Trump either had no idea or his personnel did nothing to stop it and went along with it. In fact, what's sort of telling is with Tulsi Gabbard now releasing this information, for God's sake, John Ratcliffe, who had been the director of national intelligence under Trump in the first one, he didn't release any of that. He could have, and he didn't. You got to say, what the hell? What was going on? The same for Rick Grenell. They had this information. I was writing about it back then. This shouldn't be a surprise to people, but now it's starting to get out. So what we have is in the United States, an intelligence organization that is out of control. And it is hell-bent on cultivating a narrative that's going to take us to war with Russia and China if we don't stop them.
Yeah. Here is, Larry, what Tulsi Gabbard said in terms of Russiagate.
Months leading up to the November 2016 election, the intelligence community agreed that there was no intelligence that reflected that Russia was trying to hack the election in favor of either candidate. The evidence showed, the intelligence showed, that again, Russia did not have either the intent nor the capability to be able to impact the outcome of the United States election. So it was very striking when we look back again at the documents that I declassified and released that shows there was a shift in early December, the first week of December. Again, another document was produced by the intelligence community, a president's daily brief that was consistent with every other assessment that was done previously leading up to the election. Russia was not, did not, this is after the election now, did not attempt to affect the outcome of the American election. That was never published. Hours before it would have gone into President Obama's president's daily brief, it was pulled by a senior level intelligence official saying that they had to pull it because they had received new guidance. The very next day, this meeting was called, a National Security Council meeting, bringing all together all of the senior leaders of President Obama's cabinet, and the topic that was put forward was a sensitive matter. The tasks that came out of that meeting was coming from President Obama directing the intelligence community, then Obama's ODNI director, Clapper, to produce a document, to produce an intelligence assessment that detailed not if, but how Moscow affected the outcome of the election that had already occurred, electing Donald Trump to the presidency. This document that they published in January of 2017 was the foundational groundwork that they continued to reference over and over and over again to enact this years-long coup against President Trump.
Yeah, and I want to get to that right now because I've heard...
Yeah, you know, I've been a part of that kind of process where you have to produce a document and, you know, you get the political pressure back. What's noteworthy, you know, she didn't mention it, but so you've got only about five agencies in the U.S. government that actually collect raw intelligence. And, you know, so in the CIA, when you have human intelligence, that means case officers have recruited a spy. So let's say like I've come to Brazil, I've recruited you, you're going to give me all the inside information on Brazil. And so whatever information you give, I'll write up, you know, according to Mr. Wild Blue Tropical Shirt, the Brazil is going to stop buying U.S. treasuries. Okay, so that's raw intelligence. That gets issued as an intelligence report. And then the analysts, me, I would get that. So you're on one side of the house, the operations side, you know, the information came from the operations side. I, as an analyst, take that. Well, then I've also got information that's coming from the National Security Agency. They're out intercepting, you know, they've intercepted your emails, they intercepted your phone calls. So they've got all this, you know, things that you didn't think were being heard. I've got that to look at, or I could have overhead imagery. But, you know, those are sort of the three basic. And then, you know, DIA collects human information. So does State Department, INR. When you write up these assessments, then is to be coordinated among, if you will, the collectors, those who've collected the intelligence. And what should have happened in that case with that report that was issued claiming that Russia interfered was you should have had State Department, INR, Defense Intelligence Agencies. They should have been part of the clearance process. They weren't. It was only CIA, FBI, who's not an intelligence organization. They're a law enforcement organization. Whatever information they collect is not normally distributed as intelligence, because it has to be protected for possible use in court. But you had CIA, FBI, and NSA. They coordinated on this. It was completely orchestrated. Now, to the credit, and this is, you know, at least gives you some hope, there were still some analysts in the CIA that, regardless of their political point of view, regardless of whether they liked Donald Trump or didn't like Donald Trump, they were honestly calling it, saying, hey, there is no evidence of Russian interference here. And they were shut down. That's the point. There was, no, you're not going to be allowed to say that. And I guarantee if you go back and look at what happened to their careers, I suspect those analysts who were making that case, they probably didn't get promoted. They probably didn't get elevated to any senior position, because now they were too goddamn independent to be in leaders, to be trusted with leadership. I mean, they might actually do the right thing as on a matter of principle. No. We need somebody that's going to kiss the posterior of the deep state, no matter what the cost. Lying or lying becomes the celebrated, you know, virtue. That's what's rewarded. And that's what this whole thing reveals. Tulsi Gabbard, to her credit, is putting that out, and it's an indictment of how I wouldn't trust John Ratcliffe, who's heading the CIA now, as far as you could throw him. He should have put that out back in 2019 or 2018 as Rick Grenell. It was either Grenell or Ratcliffe were both in that position. They didn't do a damn thing. They had this information. They knew this. They chose not to put it out. You got to ask, why?
Do you feel that something would happen to Barack Obama in the United States, or is going to be, it's just all a political move they're trying to gain, because they're attacking. Donald Trump is somehow feeling that the Democrats are attacking him. That's why he tries to just bring these things up to show that we have something on you.
Yeah. I don't know. Clearly, Obama should be charged with defrauding the United States, because his role in helping continue Russiagate, because we've got to, you've got to break it into phases. The initial phase actually started with the political interference of CIA in the summer of 2015 through Brennan, where information was being collected on all the presidential candidates, because in 2015, they didn't know it was going to be Donald Trump. Phase two kicked in around December 2015, January 2016, when it became clear that Donald Trump was likely to win the nomination. So then the Hillary Clinton campaign kicked off, and let's call it swift voting, the swift voting of Donald Trump as a Russian asset. And it entailed cooperation both between the Clinton campaign, the CIA, the FBI, and I'm sure the White House, Obama's White House, was helping coordinate or facilitate this. That effort, included the attempt to portray the hacking of the DNC as a Russian plot, the murder of Seth Rich, the former DNC staffer, the targeting of people like Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. But then the next phase comes when Trump is elected president, shocking the hell. Everything that they thought they'd put together to derail him. So this was now the next phase of how are we going to continue this? We're going to continue this narrative that Trump won because of the Russians, precluding Donald Trump from actually being able to have any kind of constructive engagement with Moscow and to try to put U.S.-Russian relationships on a peaceful path. Instead, this was all about ultimately going to war with Russia, and we were going to continue to provoke. And you see, Trump, I don't believe Trump was pulling the strings on this at all. I don't think he didn't even understand what was going on. He was just, you tell him, hey, Mr. President, you're the best. You're the smartest. You're the greatest. And, yeah, I am. You just tell him what he wants to hear. And meanwhile, the agency continued its effort of building secret laboratories in Ukraine of, I think there was a definite plan of that they truly believed that they would create chaos in Georgia, create chaos in the Caucasus and through Armenia and Azerbaijan, that they're going to crush Russia through all this subversion. And that was the plan. And it blew up on them. So this is now getting exposed. But will Barack Obama go to prison? He probably ought to, but I don't think he will.
So they're going to send 5 Patriot systems to the United States?
Yeah. So let's say they find, first they got to find him. So they're going to send a Patriot battery. And so each battery's got 4 launchers. Each launcher has 16 missiles. And so that gives you 64 missiles minimum. But you figure if you're going to send a launcher, you ought to have at least 2 or 3 reloads, right? So let's say you get 3 reloads. So instead of 64, you get 128, you get 188, missiles. Just do the math on that. 188 times 7 million, 700. That's almost, 560 million dollars, half a billion dollars. Just think about it. Half a billion dollars with 1 Patriot missile battery with three reloads of ammunition or missiles. That's going to be shooting down $50,000 Garand drones. Do people realize how ridiculous this is? I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
The future historians can look back going, what the hell were they thinking? Was it all that legalized marijuana that they've been smoking that's altered their consciousness? Maybe.
Did you see the factory in Russia? The factory of Jerome? It's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Russia's not good at doing small. When I say not good, they don't do things small. They do it big, you know?
These are those Shahed and something like the one that Iran has that Russia somehow upgraded or changed it. And what they're producing a lot. And
they can each one can carry 100 pounds of explosives.
Wow.
That's a big bomb. And Ukraine's only hope to try to shoot it down is hit it with, fire off four, $28 million worth of Patriot missiles, assuming that they're what they're called PAC-3s. We're getting, the U.S. has taken an ass weapon and just doesn't actually want to acknowledge it or accept it.
The Chancellor of Germany is doing nothing but digging the grave, his grave, the Germany's grave. The guy is just spending unbelievably. Why is he doing this? And how is that going to benefit Germany in a long run? It's unbelievable.
It's the ultimate example of hubris. Well, if you look back in history and wonder, as Adolf Hitler ended up sinking the fortunes of Germany and leading them to defeat, couldn't they have done something different? And so here you're watching a real-time version of that. Merz is making choices that are going to destroy Germany. I watched a little bit of Tucker's interview with this journalist from Bild, the German news outlet. And, Tucker says, saying, hey, you guys are worried. He said, you're destroying yourselves, and yet you're spending all your time worrying about trying to destroy Russia. Go clean up your own house. Take care of your own mess. Stop interfering. The Germans just don't get it. The German governing class are destroying that country. And, I spent a lot of time in Germany over the last 20 years and really enjoyed. Yeah, well, you did too. You lived there. And a great country as far as, the food was spectacular. The beer was pretty good. And the people were, they're great to be around, but you're watching this insanity that's taken hold, and it's just the impact it's having on German citizens across the country, from Berlin to Baden-Baden, and from Braunschweig up north down to, or Hamburg up north as well, down to München. It's terrible for the country.
Larry, there will be a trilateral meeting between Iran, Russia, and China.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to talk about Iran's nuclear program.
Sure.
Because it seems that Europe is preparing for snapback sanctions that was somehow considered in JCPOA. How do you see the way that Russia, it seems that it says that Europe has no right to go after that plan, snapback sanction? And how do you feel the way that, I don't know, for the case of Iranian nuclear program, what would be the approach, what would be the attitude of the Trump administration? Are they trying to put pressure on Europe, or Europe is somehow willingly tries to do for Israel?
Well,
they're trying to do everything for Israel.
Yeah, my understanding is last Tuesday, was the date actually that the snapback sanctions should have gone into effect, and apparently they didn't. So that to me says that Europe's not actually too keen on going down that path. The announcement that Iran is meeting with Russia and China to talk about its nuclear program, where they're openly putting that out there. You know, this we've had since 2018 cooperation between those three on military exercises in the Persian Gulf. But there was no, I'm not aware of any other sort of, if you will, political initiative on the part of those three countries to come together to work out a coordinated strategy that went beyond, you know, the military issue of how do we keep the Persian Gulf open, or how do we help Iran protect itself. So this means that both Russia and China, I think they're repenting for their role in the original JCPOA, because that original JCPOA would not have happened without Russia and China signing on and agreeing to support the West. You know, basically said, yeah, we'll impose sanctions.
Recognizing the right to enrich uranium for Iran.
Yeah. So now I think they're going to make a pretty clear line that, you know, Iran is a sovereign country and is fully entitled to enrich uranium if it wants to. Just like China will have that right, just like Russia will have that right. And the West lost all credibility on this issue by allowing Israel, with U.S. blessing, to launch this Pearl Harbor-style attack to decapitate the Iranian leadership and try to force a regime change. So that, you know, the West no longer has any moral standing to lecture or dictate. And Donald Trump can make all the threats he wants. You know, he's a blowhard. The fact of the matter is that if there's another round of any kind of military strikes, they're not going to be able to carry out a surprise attack like they just did in Iran. And Iran is now equipped and ready to respond and retaliate in a more massive fashion than they did before. And Israel, they're not building more THAAD and more Iron Dome and more Patriot missiles. They, you know, it's not like they're cranking out 100 a week. They might be lucky to produce 10 a month, or, you know, 10 a week maybe total. And, you know, again, if you go back to the principle, they're shooting 4 for everyone. They're going to be through those and, you know, in the first round of missile strikes, missiles and drones. So Iran's poised that, you know, it's going to do what is in its best national interest. But it's coordinating this now with Russia, clearly with Russia and China. It's not going to go its own way. In the past, you know, there were those elements of, in Pezeshkian's government in particular, that said, we want to be on our own. We don't want to do this ourselves. Now they're realizing, we need some backing. You know, we need some strong big brothers here. And China and Russia are now, I think, going to provide that.
I don't know if you read that Iran, the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, sent Ali Larijani, one of his closest guy and closest, he was the head of Iranian TV, the head of parliament in Iran, and he's so close to the supreme leader. And he sent him to Russia to talk with Vladimir Putin. He didn't use the government and agencies within the government. It seems that he had something important that he wanted to say to Russia directly, and then he wrote from him to Russia. But in your opinion, what's going on? We had in the news, Larry, that Iran bought and has received 40 J-10C fighter jets from China as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is any sort of reality to this sort of news, but it was in the news that Iran has already received those fighter jets. If that's true, how is that going to change any future attack on Iran on the part of Israelis? Are the Iranians going to use them? Do we know do we have any sort of information that they have been training with these fighter jets for?
Yeah, I've not seen any information that they've got the trained pilots for it. You know, I suppose they could be used, depending on the kind of missile system that's attached to that aircraft. I'm not, because again, I'm not an expert in that particular aircraft at all. But it could be used to, you know, go up and try to encounter the Israeli jets, because in the past, the Israeli jets, my understanding, never really fully entered into Iranian airspace. They came up to the border, they launched the air-launched missiles off that then attacked different targets. That's where the bombings and explosions were coming from. So I suppose those jets could be used in that way. They're certainly, they're going to be used for a defensive purpose. I'm not sure that's as important as getting, you know, S-400, S-500 systems from Russia installed. You know, I think I said before, I don't know what are the systems that China has, but China's have not been tested in combat, whereas Russia's has. So the Russian systems have been tested in combat and therefore have proven effective against both drones and ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. But clearly Iran is getting in a position to defend itself. And I did see comments, a short video from Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, where, he was very, he spelled it right out. He said, look, they want us to stop enrichment. That's their demand. So we give in to that. Then the next demand is, well, hey, your missile program, we got to stop that. We got to get rid of that missile program. And he says, if we do that, then they're not going to stop there. They're going to say, hey, you can no longer provide support to Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis. You got to stop that. And then once we stop that, they're going to go, hey, you know what? You can't no longer have these religious clerics running your government. You got to have, he goes, it's never going to stop. So we're not going to be pressured into meeting their demands. We're going to have a system of mutual respect, or we're not going to have relations. And we will pursue what's in our best national interest. He gets it. And so I think Larzani, that's part of the message he's carrying to Russia and saying, help us protect ourselves against these crazy people in Washington.
Yeah, they're going to have, Larry, Iran and Russia are going to have a three-day exercise and military exercise. It's called Casarex 2025 mm-hmm. in the Caspian Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the Caspian Sea is getting important in the aftermath of what has happened to Azerbaijan.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be an alternative how to get from Russia to Iran from the Caspian Sea.
Right.
Instead of using Azerbaijan.
Right.
Yeah. When you look at the situation between Russia and Ukraine and the situation in the Middle East, Larry, do you feel that we're going to have some sort of, because many people would feel, those people who still believe that Donald Trump would do something big, something different. Is the opportunity of breaking a deal, cutting a deal, is still there in the hand of the Trump administration in order to bring something big to both conflicts?
So cutting a deal with who?
I'm talking about the United States as a party to what's going on in Ukraine and what's going on in the Middle East on one side, and Russia and Iran, China on the other side, reaching some sort of security agreement, some sort of mutual understanding between the two parties, a grand strategy that would cover all these conflicts that are happening right now. Do you see the capability of that happening with the Trump administration?
No, no, not at all. Trump has no leverage in over Russia. None whatsoever. You know, the threats, oh, we're going to tariff the hell out of you. Okay, good luck with that. And that's why, you know, that news that Moscow is now taking, going to, you know, no longer be part of the gold market out of London and is going to set up an alternative system that's going to basically cater to the BRICS countries, which is, you know, 50% of the global economy right there. That's significant. So, you know, the United States hopes to try to coerce Russia into a deal. It's just not going to work. Russia's conditions have been very, very clear. Basically, NATO's got to get the hell out of Ukraine and move away from Russia's borders. And instead of NATO coming to that realization and saying, okay, we're going to do that, you're getting people, these German generals now talking about, well, the German and American generals talking about attacking Russia. Yeah, hey, let's go for World War III. Now, the nice thing is that if it comes to conflict, we don't have to worry about necessarily going nuclear thanks to the Oreshnik missile. The Oreshnik gives you something with the kind of destructive power that's needed without the radiation, without the kind of damage to civilian structures. And you know, I want to emphasize that what you're seeing, like with Russia and its military attacks across Ukraine, it looks like particularly some of the factories and warehouses are hitting. They are hitting those deliberately at night when they're not operating or when there's minimal number of personnel. They are definitely trying to limit civilian casualties. But the level of destruction, the level of attack is increasing by the Russians, and I don't see them backing off from that. So where's Trump's leverage? Trump has the ultimate leverage in the Middle East to compel Israel to stop, but he won't use it because he's captive to the Zionist lobby. He's got longstanding relationships within the Chabad community. His son-in-law, Jared, is, you know, he's part of that Zionist crowd. So, you know, Trump has sold out to him. So he's not going to get the kind of deal that he would like. And you remember he thought, oh, we're going to get all these people signed up to the Abraham Accord. That's not happening. You know, and even the Saudis, I think, are starting to, you know, really sour and recognize Trump is a big talker, and they know how to, you know, put butter on his ample ass, but they're not going to tie themselves to him because, you know, despite Trump's claims that he's more popular than ever, his actual poll numbers have been dropping, and he's losing support, not gaining support.
Yeah, I think all talk, no actions. It's over and over.
Yeah,
right now it comes back.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
Oh, man,
great pleasure, as always.
Burned up a lot of time, but we had a good chat. Yeah. Can't wait to see what shirt you're going to break out on Friday, dude. All right, you have
see
a good day.
Beautiful. Right. But you were shining. You were shining. It was.
Thanks, man. We'll talk later. Bye.